Welcome. Welcome to Thinking Matters, listening to Dr. Matt Flanagan. It's great pleasure to have you all here to listen and to think about important issues. Just some things to help organize things. If you're wondering where the bathrooms are, just go through those doors right there, and there is a man and woman's washroom there that you can use. Though, if there's a really long lineup in the women's side and no men are using the washroom, feel free to exchange. There's only one person in each washroom anyway. What is Thinking Matters? Well, Thinking Matters is an organization that desires to provide New Zealanders, in particular, a resources and tools to better articulate the Christian faith in the 21st century. And so what we really want to do is we want to put in the hands of Christians here in Auckland and all over New Zealand actual good, tangible resources that they can use in their dialogue with other people. But what we also want to provide is opportunities to actually practice and learn the practical side of apologetics and evangelism and how to share and articulate the Christian faith. It's easy to go online and see a lot of good resources and stuff, but sometimes we wonder, how can I actually take this argument and actually use it in an everyday conversation? And so we are an organization that is excited about giving people those tools to do those sorts of things. Also, we are, in particular, Thinking Matters Auckland is starting to go into Christian schools to help answer questions for high school students about the Christian faith. If that's something that you are interested in, that you feel like, you know what, I want to do something, I want to start articulating, sharing my faith in the public square, and you want to be on a team that goes into these schools to answer questions for high school students, that option is open to you, and feel free to talk to me afterwards about that. I would also encourage, we have an email list that is going to be going around. I would encourage you to put your email down if it is of interest of you to actually go into high schools or actually learn more about Thinking Matter events such as tonight. We also want to, there's at the end of April, on April 20, is Zach here? April 26th, a Friday, at the end of the month, we will be holding a conference featuring world-leading Christian thinkers discussing how faith relates to our secular culture. This will be a unique opportunity to have some of the most experienced and effective communicators on these issues answer your questions in person. The main speaker will be Dr. Glenn Peoples, a well-known New Zealand blogger on issues of faith and society, and we're lucky to have him here in Auckland with us. Workshops will also be led by philosophers Dr. Matt Flanagan, one of our speakers tonight, and Dr. Chris Tucker, and other distinguished communicators and philosophers and theologians in the New Zealand area. The location will be in Avondale at a place called GAPS, and it's a bit like a cross between a library, a batch, and a small retreat center, and is ideal for relaxed seminars and discussion. And if you want to know more about that, again, just put your email on the email list. And the cost approximately for that will be about $15. So why are we here tonight? We're here tonight to wrestle with the question, why defend Christianity? It's interesting, as I was walking down Crean Street a few days ago, there was a Hindu missionary there handing out Bhagavad Gitas, the Hindu scriptures. And my first reaction when I saw the missionary was, I don't want to listen to you. I don't want to talk to you, which is weird because I love talking to people about the Christian faith and I love talking about these important questions, but it was just a natural instinct. And also across from my house is a Hindu sect that practices and worships at like 5 a.m. And they're always filling the car, the parking in front of my house. And I went there on their, they had an open house, and I went through about 2.5 hours of their sort of introduction to Hinduism, and just the whole time I was just like, man, this is kind of crazy. This is just mind-boggling. I mean, they're really good people, they're really nice, but this is just crazy. And it just really dawned on me then, you know, that's exactly what people think about the Christian faith. When I talk to them, they probably think I'm crazy. They hear me talk about virgins and births and God's dying on cross, and they just go, man, that's crazy. I can just be a good person myself. I don't, anything you're selling me just isn't worth it. And so I just realized that it's just part of our culture. We're kind of trained. We kind of just have this instinctual instinct not to want to talk about these things. It makes us uncomfortable, and we feel that it will just distract us and all the sorts of things like that. And so what is great about tonight is that it doesn't have to stay that way. There are ways to overcome these obstacles and engage in fruitful, wonderful, gospel-changing conversations. And I've learned some of these ways from the man who's about to speak, Dr. Matt Flanagan here. He's been a very influential person for me. I've read his blog for years. Actually, if you can't notice, I'm not from New Zealand. Before I came to New Zealand, I specifically emailed Matt Flanagan to ask him for his advice and things like that, and he gave some good sage advice, and I greatly appreciate that. He's part of the reason why I'm here in New Zealand, and it's just, he's a really brilliant guy, really good guy, really nice guy, and someone who can really focus our thinking. And so I just want to ask Dr. Matt Flanagan to come up here, and let's give him a round of applause. Yeah. Why defend Christianity, Matt?
Thank you, Mark. That was far too generous. Okay, I'm going to talk tonight about why defend Christianity. And the term that's often used for defending Christianity is this term called apologetics. And that term has a tendency to put people off, but I'm not going to shy away from the term tonight. Instead, I'm going to focus on two things. First, I'll briefly sketch what apologetics is and talk a little bit about some of the biblical background to this idea. And then secondly, I want to look at three sort of common objections to the Christian faith and outline a kind of strategy for how they could be responded to. So there's really two things. One, to introduce you to the subject, and secondly, to give you some kind of ideas of the types of responses, the types of strategies you might make in doing it. So that's how my talk will be focused tonight. So if you were to put that up there, first, what is apologetics? And secondly, common challenges. And the three challenges I'm going to look at, by the way, are it's irrational to believe in things which can't be proven, that pluralism makes faith arbitrary, and evil disproves the existence of God. Okay, so what's this weird thing called apologetics? Well, the word apologetics comes from the Greek word apologia, which is sometimes translated as the word apology. Now, this is unfortunate because in contemporary English, the word apology means to say you're sorry and carries with it the idea of remorse. So if you say I'm apologizing for something, you mean, well, I made a mistake, I was wrong, I shouldn't have done it, I'm sorry. But the ancient word that the English word comes from had quite a different connotation and quite a different meaning. In ancient Greece, the word apology was used of a defense a person would offer in a court of the law to rebut charges or accusations brought against them. The ancient Greeks had the ancient Athenians had a jury system which our system is based on, and they would try people by making accusations against them, and then that person would stand up before his peers, and he would try and argue that the accusations were false. And this became for the ancient Greeks who were into their philosophy and their debating and what have you, people became very skilled at doing this. In fact, the most famous apology in history probably comes from a man called Socrates, who was tried by the Athenian Assembly in 399 BC. Those of you who have studied classical history will know about this. He was executed by the Athenians for corrupting the youth and rejecting the traditional gods of Athens. And there's a famous book written by a philosopher called Plato called The Apology, which is Socrates' defense against those charges. Now, this word apologia in Greek appears several times in the New Testament. Perhaps the most famous place is in 1 Peter 3:15. This is what 1 Peter 3:15 says. You can read it on the OHP. But even if you do not suffer for doing what is right, even if you do suffer for doing what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear what they fear, and do not be intimidated. But in your hearts, sanctify Christ as Lord. Always be ready to make your defense to anyone who demands from you an accounting for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and reverence. Keep your conscience clear, so that when you are maligned, those who abuse you for your good conduct in Christ may be put to shame. Okay, so the word defense here in verse 15. In other translations like the NIV, it has the word answer. And this word in Greek is apologia. And it's referring to rebutting accusation or charges that are made against you in a rational way. And the context of this passage is in 1 Peter is in a context of persecution. In the previous few verses and chapters, Peter has been telling the church how to conduct themselves in a context where persecution is beginning to come on the church. And of course, this is a period of time when there was a transition in early Christianity where the church was persecuted by Jews and protected by the Roman authorities. And as it began to get more influential, the Roman authorities began to turn a negative eye towards Christianity and that persecution began to get wrenched up. And so Peter is given instructions to wives in situations where they might be persecuted by their husbands, or slaves who are in a situation where they might be persecuted by their masters. And you see in verse 16, reference to people maligning the believer with false accusations. And it's in this context that Peter says, he tells his audience, be ready to give an apology. Be ready to give a defense to anyone who demands for an accounting for the hope you have. And the word accounting here is the Greek word logos, which means reason. So what he's saying is that when you're in a context where people mock your faith and malign it and think it's stupid and silly and they're going to have a go at you about it, be ready to give a reasoned defense when they demand from you, they start asking you questions, why do you believe this garbage? Be willing to give a reasoned defense. Be willing, be prepared to say something rational in response. That's what Peter is essentially saying in this point here, in this passage here. You know. Now, of course, Peter stresses that this is to be done with respect, and he emphasizes giving a godly life. And this, of course, is important. No one would, I think, downplay the importance of good character and these sorts of things. But notice, he doesn't say that that's all you need. He doesn't say, well, just live a good life and it doesn't matter what you say. He says, lead a good life and be prepared to give a rational answer. And I think that's an important point in the contemporary church in New Zealand, because my experience with the contemporary church in New Zealand is there's often this attitude that if you just love people and you're just nice to them, it doesn't matter what you say. And my experience on university campuses is that's actually fatal to the Christian faith, because what happens is people find that they're in a community of people who might be really nice, but they're airheads. And they can't honestly associate with these people because they're these really rational students, and although these people are nice, they're clueless. Right? And it's not an either or, it's a both and. And what's interesting is if you look at the New Testament carefully, particularly the book of Acts, you'll find that engaging in this sort of thing called apologetics was actually a normal part of the early church's missionary activity. And I'm just going to skim quickly through three chapters in Acts here, 17 to 19. In Acts 17, verse 2, Luke tells us that Paul's custom was to, this is what he says, as was his custom, Paul went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days, he reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and proving that the Messiah had to suffer and rise from the dead. That's what he says here. Paul goes into the synagogues, and he reasons with them, and he starts giving them these arguments. Right? When Paul arrives in Athens, shortly later in the same passage, Luke tells us that he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. And the text goes on in Acts 17:17 to tell us that a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him about this. Right? Then later, in Acts 18 in Corinth, Luke tells us that every Sabbath, he, Paul, reasoned in the synagogue, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. Notice what he does. He goes in the synagogue and he reasons with them and he tries to persuade them rationally. All right. At the end of chapter 18, we hear that Paul can help to convert and instruct a man called Apollos who vigorously refuted his Jewish opponents in public debate. That's what it says at the end of Acts chapter 18. Then in chapter 19, Luke tells us that Paul spent 3 months in the synagogue in Ephesus arguing persuasively about the kingdom of God. When people became obstinate, Luke tells us, Paul left the synagogue, took the disciples with him, and had discussions daily in a lecture hall. And he goes on to say, and this meant the word of God was heard in the city. Since in the book of Acts, apologetics was a normal part of Paul's missionary practice, the distinction that we have today between apologetics and evangelism doesn't appear to be in the book of Acts. Okay, Paul goes in, he says, I believe this. Let's have a discussion about it. I'll give you some reasons. I'll reason with you. You'll dialogue with me. We'll go back and forth. And he does this regularly. This was his custom. Right? And in fact, and just one more, couple more scriptures here, Paul himself equates in 2 Corinthians 10 apologetics with spiritual warfare. Now, I don't know if you've heard, I know in New Zealand church there's lots of really interesting ideas about this, I think, called spiritual warfare. But this is what Paul says about spiritual warfare. For though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. So what's he talking about? Divine power to demolish strongholds. This is what he says. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take every thought captive and make it obedient to Christ. So what's fighting as the world does not fight? What is fighting in this kind of war in a way the world does not do? Well, here Paul suggests that spiritual warfare is Christians are engaged in a war over ideas. False ideologies are spiritual strongholds. And Christians fight this battle by tearing down these strongholds. How? Well, by demolishing the arguments that support these ideologies. That's what Paul says here. Doing this involves bringing the ideas of the world into obedience to Christ. When you look at the New Testament, you'll see this idea of apologetics is not this kind of weird thing, or it's a thing that professional theologians do, or it's a thing that's kind of peripheral to the Christian life, or it's this highly academic exercise. It's part of normal evangelism. It's part of people living in the world in a hostile culture where other people are going to go up to them and ask them and hassle them and demand a defense from them. It's part of being a Christian is to battle the false ideas of the world and try and persuade people to not be involved in them and try and save people from false ideologies and so on. This is part of the Christian life. This is a normal part of the Christian life. And I think it's unfortunate in New Zealand we have, to some extent, lost this. And so we have often equated evangelism with friendship and potluck dinners rather than actually engaging in what Scripture says was a normal part of the Christian life. And just one last thing. It's interesting if you look in the book of Titus, when Paul lays down what are the requirements for an elder, he lays down various character requirements, which of course are very important. And he says an elder must be able to teach. Does anyone know what it says next? And refute those who object to sound doctrine. Must be able to teach and refute those who object to sound doctrine. In other words, Paul envisaged elders not just to be able to stand up and give expository sermons, but also to be able to respond to the kinds of objections that people would raise. And this makes perfect sense. I've been a part-time minister for a few years, and I can't imagine doing youth ministry without a working knowledge of apologetics. It astounds me that people, often I hear my theological colleagues tell me, oh, apologetics is irrelevant for youth ministry. What do you do when the young person goes out and watches the Da Vinci Code and then comes up to you and says, didn't Constantine invent the Bible in the 3rd century? What do you say to them? Have some pizza and play a guitar? Onto that. Anybody in a position of leadership, you're the one they're going to ask. And so this makes eminent sense. An elder must be not just be able to teach, but be able to respond to the kinds of questions people will ask him about sound teaching. He's the person that people go to with their spiritual questions. He's going to be the person that new converts go to asking for answers. And if they don't get it from the leaders in the church, they're going to assume there are no answers. So this is, I think, this is an important part of Christian discipleship and Christian life, which is just often neglected in the church today. So that's a little bit about what apologetics is and some of the sort of scriptural basis for it. I was in the US a few months ago where I did a kind of apologetics missionary trip, and it was really a weird thing to have apologetics as just part of a normal missionary environment. And it was refreshing. We went into universities, and we dialogued with people, and we answered their questions, and we spoke to youth, and what have you. And it was really, really interesting to see how apologetics can be streamlined into the mainstream Christian life. You know, you could be sitting down somewhere, you know, at a pub or a university or whatever, and somebody says, oh, I saw this on the news, or I heard this, and they raise some issues. And you say, well, actually, no, that's not correct, and here's why. And you start reasoning with them. You start saying, I think what you're saying is false, and here's why. Back and forth, and the person interested, ask questions, what have you. That should be a normal part, and we should be capable of doing that. So now let's look at the second part of my talk, the objections to the Christian faith. I want to look at a few common objections, but before doing that, I want to just talk a little bit about the stance I think we should take towards such criticisms. Now, when I was at university, a lot of skeptics attacked me in my first few years of university, and I kind of had to wet my feet by, you know, engaging in this sort of thing pretty much the hard way, just being thrown in the deep end. But a few years later, I read a book by a guy called Timothy Keller called Reasons for God. Timothy Keller is a minister in New York City who is in a very secular liberal part of the US. And he has lots of 20-something people in his church. So he's dealing with people who are educated, white, you know, sort of middle-class people who are skeptical, liberal, this sort of thing. And he wrote this book, Reasons for God, which is about how he sort of engages with these people in his church. And in there, he summarizes an attitude towards doubt, which I think is very, very helpful. And it certainly rang true with my own experiences on university campuses. So I'll just read a bit what Timothy Keller says about doubt, which is quite good. He says, "All doubts, however skeptical and cynical they may seem," and listen to this carefully, "are really a set of alternative beliefs. You cannot doubt belief A except from position of faith in belief B." You think about that. If somebody raises an objection, they raise an objection because this is false because something else that they believe. Right? So they doubt belief A from the perspective of faith and belief B. Right? And then he says, "The only way to doubt Christianity rightly and fairly is to discern the alternative belief under each of your doubts and then ask yourself what reasons you have for believing that. How do you know that that belief is true? It would be inconsistent to require more justification for Christian belief than you do for your own. But that's frequently what happens. In fairness, you must doubt your doubts. My thesis is that if you come to recognize the belief on which your doubts about Christianity are based, and you seek as much proof for those beliefs as you seek from Christians, from theirs, you will discover your doubts are not as solid as they first appeared." Now, I think that's really sound advice from a pastor in the US for dealing with skeptical people. Really, really sound advice. He's saying when people doubt, they doubt from a perspective of belief in something else. And what we as Christians must never do is allow them to demand a burden of proof up here for us and then uncritically hold these beliefs to no burden of proof at all. All right? So one of the things I want to look at when we go through these objections is to look at some of the implicit background beliefs behind some of the questions that are raised and then sort of intersect with these beliefs and ask some critical questions about these beliefs and ask if, you know, these people are going to, if these kinds of beliefs themselves can be subjected to the kind of skepticism that people are trying to subject Christianity to, right? I think it's a general strategy and a general good way of dialoguing with skeptical people is to take this kind of approach and to not let yourself be put in a situation where you have to justify everything you say, but everyone else can utter whatever they like, right? As Keller says, the way to doubt Christianity fairly is to ascertain the alternative beliefs which the doubts are based on, and then ask, how do we know they are true? Are we willing to apply the same skeptical standards to those as we do to Christianity? So now let's look at three common objections and just see how this pans out with them. Well, the first one I want to look at is that the idea that it's irrational to believe things which can't be proven. Now, since the 17th century, this was a very popular view around then, the time of what's known as the Enlightenment, one of the most common objections to the Christian faith was the claim that Christianity was irrational because its central tenets could not be proven to be true. And a contemporary version of this comes from a philosopher called John Mackey, who wrote a very famous book called The Miracle of Theism. This was probably one of the most influential defenses of atheism in the 20th century. And the title, The Miracle of Theism, comes from a famous dialogue written by a 17th century philosopher called David Hume. And David Hume basically wrote, he said, the only miracle that you can believe in is the fact that people believe in Christianity. Right? People would believe in that itself as a miracle. Well, that was his kind of sarcastic comment. This is what Mackey says at the start of his book when he's laying out what he's going to do in the rest of the book. He says, if it is agreed that the essential assertions of theism means belief in God, are literally meaningful, it must also be admitted that they are not directly verified or verifiable. What he means here is you can't see, hear, touch, tell God exists just by your five senses. He says, it follows then that any rational consideration of whether or not they are true will involve arguments. Whether or not God exists must be examined either by deductive arguments, inductive reasoning, or if that yields no decision, by arguments to the best explanation. For in this context, nothing else has any coherent bearing on the issue. So what Mackey's saying here, to put this in layman's terms, is that a rational consideration of theism, which he means belief in God, depends on the arguments that can be put forward in favor of this belief. If belief in God is to be rational, the person who believes in God must prove it in some way. He must give an argument. He must provide what's called a deductive argument, which is sort of more mathematical, or an inductive argument, which is sort of looking at probabilities, or a kind of scientific argument to the explanation for the existence of God. And if he can't do those things, his belief is irrational. And Mackey, of course, then goes on in the book to argue that this can't be done. Right? So you can kind of see the method he's assuming. Religious beliefs have to be sort of proven in some way. They have to be demonstrated in a kind of quasi-scientific way or something like that. Now, an initial question to ask, notice that this is the belief that underlies the skeptical doubt here, right? An initial question to ask is, why assume this? Why assume that religious beliefs have to be proven to be rational? And you might think, well, of course, every belief has to do that, doesn't it? Well, actually, no. It's important to note that not everything we believe needs to be proven to be rational. There are at least two reasons for this. The first is that if you claim everything must be proven, you quickly get into what philosophers call a regress problem. What's a regress problem? Well, I've got a quote here by a guy called Roy Clouser who puts it in a really straightforward way, and you'll see the problem immediately. He says, if everything needs to be proven, then the premises of every proof would need to be proven. But if you need a proof for every proof, you need a proof for your proof and a proof for your proof of your proof and so on forever. All right? And this makes no, thus it makes no sense to demand that everything be proven because you will go on for infinity. And see the point, you try and prove something, you say, well, why is it true? Oh, because of these facts here, and they prove it. Then you can ask, well, why are those facts true? Can you prove those? Oh, here's these further facts over here. They prove. Well, what about those? Can you prove those? And you can go on forever with this. All right? And so for this reason, it's pretty much unanimous. I think it's almost unanimous amongst philosophers of knowledge that you don't need to prove every belief for it to be rational. Otherwise, we couldn't believe anything. A second problem is there are many things which we believe quite rationally which actually can't be proven in this way. Now, such things as that there is a chair in front of me or that the people in front of me have thoughts and feelings. Now, you might think, well, that's obvious. We can prove that. Well, if you've studied the history of philosophy, you'll actually find that this is actually very difficult to prove. To somebody, if you were to come across somebody who seriously, which no one does, but someone who seriously believed there were no chairs there and that everybody around them didn't have thoughts and feelings, it would be very hard to come up with some proof that would be come anywhere close to demonstrating to that person that this was the case. Right? And this is sort of widely seen in the literature. So there are some things we can believe quite rationally even though we don't have a proof for them. So that raises this question. Why then do religious beliefs need to be proven? Why do they have to meet the standard of proof if not all beliefs need to meet it? What's special about religious beliefs? Why are they in the category of needs to be proven in this way? Well, Alvin Plantinga, who's a Christian philosopher who I have great admiration for and whose work has influenced me immensely, he put this question to a conference, and he got this answer from a leading skeptic called Kai Nielsen. This is what he says. All of us can agree that at least for a large range of cases, whether someone is in pain or whether someone is thinking or whether they're anxious, not in general argue about these things. Only a madman would claim that no one is ever in pain or that no one ever knows that another person is thinking or whatever. In religion, however, the situation is different. So notice what Kai Nielsen's saying here. The basic idea is that religious beliefs are beliefs that not all people, or at least not all sane people, believe. Whereas beliefs about other people having thoughts and feelings and so on are beliefs that all sane people accept. And so because religious beliefs are beliefs that, you know, there are intelligent people and sane people who reject them, they fall into the category of beliefs that need to be proven. You see this? You see how this works? So if we were to put this together into a more sort of formal argument, the argument or the objection here goes like this. A belief is rational if it is either A, acknowledged to be true by all sane people, or B, can be proven from premises that are acknowledged to be true by all sane people. Right? That's what they're getting at here, right? The idea is that you don't need to prove everything, but it's beliefs that people disagree about you need to prove. It's beliefs that sane people have a dispute about. Right? And second, religious beliefs are not acknowledged by all sane people, nor can they be proven to be true from beliefs acknowledged by all sane people. Now, there's a lot you could say in response to this. But you notice what I've done here. I've tried to unpack the basic assumptions behind the objection so you can kind of understand where the person's coming from. And just one response that I would sketch to this is I think that one, the first premise, is self-refuting. What do I mean by a self-refuting statement? Well, imagine I got up and I said to you tonight, I do not understand a word of English. I can't speak a single sentence in English. And I said that in English. Right? You'd immediately, like somebody's already laughing, right? You'd already see the problem. By asserting it in English, I'm showing that what I'm saying is false, right? I'm refuting my own statement. Now, look at this claim in one, right? One states that if something is not acknowledged by all people to be true, then it needs to be proven. Here's the problem. One itself is not acknowledged by all sane people. There are many theologians, philosophers, and everyday people who don't accept one, right? So, if one is true, we are irrational in believing it until the person who utters it proves it. You see that? So if a person raises this objection against Christianity, and this is the assumption, they have to actually prove this before we can rationally accept them. Know so that any proof they offer has to appeal only to premises that all sane people in the world accept. So when they offer a proof for it, we can then ask the question about the premises of their proof and say, well, do all people accept that? No. Okay, prove that. And until it actually meets that standard, you're actually irrational in accepting one. You're actually accepting a self-contradictory statement. Right? And I don't think that anyone has actually ever demonstrated one to that level of proof. I don't think anyone has ever given an argument for the truth of one that appeals to premises that all rational, sane people, you know, all philosophers and theologians and scholars in the world and what have you, and everyday people accept. In fact, there are very few claims of any significance that meet that level of proof. Right? So what you see here, I think, is a problem with this kind of rejection of belief in God. The skeptic rejects God's existence out of allegiance to certain assumptions about what counts as a rational belief. The problem is that these assumptions are in the same boat as religious belief is alleged to be in. So a person who rejects belief in God on this basis is being inconsistent. He has a contradictory position. And I think this illustrates nicely the point that Timothy Keller made, you know, that often doubts are made based on beliefs. And when you try and subject these alternative beliefs to the same standards that they demand of the Christian, these beliefs don't stand up. You see? It's quite a good illustration of it. So let's look at the second challenge, and I think the second challenge is this idea of pluralism. I think it can be responded to in a fairly similar fashion. In fact, it's a very similar objection. And this is the claim that it is arbitrary, dogmatic, irrational, bigoted, and so on, to claim that Christianity is true in the face of pervasive religious pluralism. Now, what is religious pluralism? Well, religious pluralism is just the fact that there are numerous different religious and secular perspectives in the world today. You know, there are Buddhists, there are Hindus, there are Muslims, there are Jews, there are different denominations of Christianity, there's communism, there's Marxism, there's secular humanism, there's libertarian, there's all these different views in the world. And the idea is that for you to say that Christianity is true is somehow arrogant or bigoted or irrational. It's arbitrary. Right? The idea is that if you affirm that Christianity is true, then you're affirming a stance, or taking a stance, which contradicts the beliefs of so many other people, so many rival perspectives. And how do you do that? That's arbitrary and that's arrogant, right? You've probably heard this kind of line of argument before. So what would you say about this? Well, the first thing to note, I think, is you need to understand, again, as Timothy Keller says, that this objection is based on an alternative belief. The belief that it is arbitrary to believe a proposition in the absence of proof if numerous other people hold perspectives that reject that proposition. That's the assumption that he's making here, right? It's arbitrary to believe a proposition in the absence of proof if numerous people hold to a perspective that rejects that proposition. Now, a little reflection should demonstrate the problem with this claim. First, the claim is self-refuting. That claim itself is a claim that not everybody holds. People who hold to exclusivist religious views don't accept that claim. So if the claim was true, it would refute itself. You would be arbitrary and irrational in accepting it. So it's a self-refuting claim. But I think there's also a deeper issue here. Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, I accept the objection here and I accept his advice. What should I do? He's pointed out to me that there's all these other religions and other secular perspectives and so on. And I believe Christianity and this is arbitrary. What should I do? What would be the appropriate response? Well, presumably, the appropriate response would be to cease to believe in the Christian faith. But if I cease to believe in the Christian faith, aren't I adopting a position that is contrary to the view held by many people? All those Christians who accept the Christian faith. Right? So now I'm adopting a perspective that's rejected by a large number of people. But that's not what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be not doing that. That's arbitrary. If I become an atheist, then I'm rejecting the perspective of all the huge number of religious people in Islam and Judaism, Christianity and Hinduism who believe in God. If I accept agnosticism and I say agnosticism is the right perspective, then I'm in disagreement with everyone who disagrees with agnosticism. See, the point is that you can't actually... And so this leads to what I call the problem of special pleading. If you're going to say that it's arbitrary to believe a position that is part of a perspective that's rejected by large numbers of people, the problem is you can't get out of that no matter what you do on any substantial, major, significant question. You're going to be forced into the same situation. If you reject Christianity, you're going to be rejecting a position that large numbers of people reject. If you become an atheist, you're going to be doing it. If you're an agnostic, you're going to be doing it. And so this argument either refutes all these perspectives, which would mean you should believe nothing, but then, of course, believing nothing would be taking a stance contrary to everyone as well, right? Or it refutes none. But you can't say that this refutes Christianity, but not every other position. And so this leads to what logicians call special pleading. Special pleading is when you accept a line of reasoning or argument in your own case, in a particular case, but refuse to accept it in other cases. A person would say, well, you know, nobody should kill and then stab someone. You know, and you say, well, and they give these compelling reasons for why it's never wrong to kill, and they stab someone. You say, well, hang on. So, oh, no. When I was talking to you, I said, it's never wrong to kill. When it's me, I don't say that. That makes no sense, right? If it's never wrong to kill, it's never wrong to kill. That's what you call special pleading, right? And it's the same thing here. If you're going to say, you can't adopt a viewpoint that there's a huge amount of pluralism about, well, then that must apply to any viewpoint there's huge amounts of pluralism about. And most skeptics will adopt views that they'll reject Christianity and then adopt views that are just as controversial in terms of pluralism as Christianity is. It might be a few people, but the vast majority of the world are not white Western liberal agnostics. Right? Most cultures do not accept those views. Most cultures do not accept have not historically accepted that many of the moral and political and philosophical beliefs that modern people and modern enlightened people accept. They are just as subject to a pluralism challenge as Christianity is. So it makes no sense to, in the name of those kinds of ideologies, reject Christianity because of pluralism. Right? In fact, I could just give it a bit of an anecdote about this. There was an article, there was a book by a guy called John Loftus. I don't know if you've come across John Loftus. He's a sort of popular atheist blogger, and he's written this book called Why I Became an Atheist. And in that book, he advocates this thing called the outsider test. And the idea is that you should be skeptical about all your beliefs. But of course, he's not skeptical about everything, because he'd have to be skeptical about the moon landing and all sorts of stuff, right? So what he says is you should be skeptical of all those beliefs, which, if you look across cultures, you find people have disagreed about. Then the rest of his book talks about modern science and how it proves God doesn't exist. Talks about how Christianity is really oppressive because it violates all these liberal values. Talks about his particular take on what knowledge is. Talks about all these things. When I was reviewing the book, I sort of said I made this straightforward point to Loftus. I sort of said, well, isn't every single objection you raise in the book subject to the outsider test? Culture accept modern science? Did every culture accept those moral values you used to criticize the Old Testament with? Did every culture accept those political views you appeal to? Does every culture accept your understanding of what reason is? So if you believe in the outsider test, you should reject everything you said in the book. Right? I've never seen an answer to that kind of challenge. At that stage, you just got mad, but wrote several blog posts about how stupid I was and blah, blah. It was really quite funny. But last objection that I always want to look at is this idea that doesn't evil disprove the existence of God? So the last objection I want to look at touches on the fact that this world contains numerous instances of suffering and evil. And many, throughout the centuries, this is not a new idea, have suggested that this fact makes belief in Christianity demonstrably false. And so in this sort of context, people ask the question, why does God allow evil? So you know the situation, somebody goes into a high school and shoots a whole lot of children. Say, well, why did God allow that? Or somebody dies of cancer, or there's a major earthquake, or something happens. It's interesting, actually, that throughout history this objection has been raised, and every now and then something happens where people think that somehow this is a new idea. So you have a major earthquake, and people go, oh, this just proves God didn't exist. Have there been earthquakes in history? Do you think people didn't know centuries ago that earthquakes existed? I mean, in the 17th century, there was an earthquake called the Liston earthquake, which killed thousands of people, and Voltaire wrote, you know, why does God, you know. So this isn't new, but every now and then some act of suffering happens in a person's life, and they raise this question naturally, right? They ask, why does God allow evil? Now, it's important to note that this is often raised as a kind of rhetorical question. Why does God allow evil? There's this challenge. You have to answer this question. But as with many rhetorical questions, it actually hides a disguised argument. So philosopher Daniel Howard Scheidner, this is how he says it. He says, the theoretical problem of evil is often expressed in the form of a pointed question. God is able to prevent evil and suffering, and he would know about them before they happened, right? Moreover, since he's unsurpassably good, surely he would not permit them just for the fun of it. So why doesn't he prevent them? So the arguments Snyder alludes to here can be really put into two premises. First is that the claim that God, being omniscient and omnipotent, that is all-powerful and all-knowing, would both know about all the suffering in the world and be able to prevent it. Second is that because God is good, God would not allow such evil to exist unless he had some kind of good reason for it. And this is what is often called a justifying reason, a reason that is compatible with never doing wrong and being perfect in love and so on. Now, if you accept both these claims, then the conclusion is that God must have a good reason for allowing suffering. If it's true that God, being all-knowing and all-powerful, would know about suffering and be able to prevent it, and it's true that God, being good, would not allow suffering to exist unless he had a good reason for it, if those two things are true, then the conclusion is that God must have some kind of reason for allowing suffering, right? And this is where the kind of question kicks in. People say, well, what is it then? What's God's reason? You tell me. Explain it to me. Give me an answer. Now, the rhetorical force of this argument is very powerful. And its emotional appeal has a really strong pull. And sometimes, you know, this is said in a time of great grief or great crisis and great emotion. And that makes it difficult to separate the kind of philosophical side of it from the pastoral caring side of it. And it's important that we're sensitive to that. But at the same time, we still have to ask the question about, no matter how emotionally upset a person is, we still have to ask the question of what is true. Things that one of the problems we see in our culture is often we have this tendency to think that if there's enough emotion in the situation, we can ignore the facts of the matter. So we have advertisers who, for a political cause, who think if they want to promote a political cause, they just get a really good story of someone who's really feels really victimized and gives a really emotional account of how such and such will benefit them. And we think, oh, well, obviously just social policy. You know, a very, very bad way to actually think about morality, you know, purely in terms of just, I feel emotionally sympathetic to this person without assessing the facts of the matter. And this kind of, I want to point out, this argument has a important flaw. And it's not just me that says this. This flaw is widely noticed in the literature. People like Steve Weikestra, Alvin Plantinga, Peter van Engwagen, William Rowe, Michael Tooley, William Alston. If you're a philosopher, you'll know all those names. If you're not, just ignore them. And the flaw is this. What this argument establishes that is that if God exists, he must have a good reason for allowing it. That's what this argument establishes. Okay. However, when someone asks the question, why does God allow evil? They're asking you, what God's reasons are? But notice there's a different question between saying, if God exists, he must have a reason, and the question of, can you tell me what the reason is? They're not the same question. Right? The assumption here is that if a Christian cannot give a detailed account of what God's reasons are, there probably aren't any. See, this is the assumption that's lying behind this. If a Christian cannot give a detailed account of what God's reasons are, then there probably are none. This is the kind of assumption that's at work here. And this is the assumption on which this argument hangs or falls. If the fact that a Christian can't provide God's reasons and details does not mean we have any reason for thinking there are none, then his inability to answer the question, why does God allow it, doesn't prove that God doesn't exist, right? God can only not exist if you assume that he has to be able to answer that question for God to exist, right? Or he has to be able to give some kind of account of it. Okay. And the problem is this assumption is questionable. And Alvin Plantinga gives a kind of witty illustration of this. And Alvin Plantinga often gives witty illustrations, but I'll read this out to you. He says, I look inside my tent. Before I read this, you have to know what a no-see-um is. Okay, no-see-um apparently in North America is a really tiny sort of insect that has this bite that's really, you know, it's a bite you're going to remember, but they're really tiny, they're really hard to see. This is what Alvin Plantinga says. I look inside my tent, I don't see a Saint Bernard. Then it's probable that there's no Saint Bernard in the tent. This is because if there were one, I would very likely to have seen it. It's not easy for a Saint Bernard to avoid detection in a small tent. I said this at a school once and someone asked me what a Saint Bernard is. I hope nobody asked me that, but okay. Again, I look inside my tent. I don't see any no-see-ums. Very small midges with a bite out of all proportion to their size. This time, it's not particularly probable that there are no no-see-ums in my tent. At least not any more probable than when I first looked. The reason, of course, is if there were no-see-ums there, I wouldn't see them. They're too small to see. The point here, these two cases, the case of the St. Bernard and the case of the no-see-um. As Plantinga goes on to note, the assumption behind this kind of argument from evil is that God's reasons for allowing evil are like St. Bernard's in a small tent, not like no-see-ums. All right? And so as Timothy Keller notes, we see lurking within this hard-nosed skepticism an enormous faith in our cognitive faculties. If we plumb the depths of the universe for answers to suffering, and we can't find any, then we assume there are none. So in order for this kind of rhetorical question, why does God allow evil, to propose a threat to the rationality of the Christian faith, it seems what is needed from the skeptic is some argument as to why God's detailed reasons for allowing evil are like St. Bernard's. Right? And arguments from some kind of premises that Christians are rationally required to accept. Because, of course, if the argument comes from a premise that a Christian is not rationally required to accept, he can just reject the premise and go on his rational way, right? And I'm inclined to think this assumption has it's at least in the face of it, it's quite questionable. It seems to suggest that if a finite human being with limited factual knowledge, a limited perspective in time and space, and imperfect moral character does not know any reason why an event could be allowed to occur, it follows that an omniscient, perfectly good being would not have any reasons either. And this just seems to me obviously mistaken. William Alston has noted the skeptic here is a bit like a person who, with no background in quantum mechanics, like me, decided that when he could not understand why the world's leading physicist held a particular view, obviously the physicist had no reason to accept it. Right? No. He's saying, well, you know, I can't see any reason why an omniscient being wouldn't allow it, so an omniscient being doesn't have any reason for allowing it. That assumes that you have enough information to assess what an omniscient being would allow. Or at least a representative sample of some sort, right? Yeah. So that I think is I mean, there's a huge amount of literature on this, and I can't get into in great detail. But that I think is the heart of the problem with this kind of argument. It assumes that we have this level of knowledge that it's disputable that we have, and there's this kind of skepticism on one hand, and on the other hand, this huge confidence in our ability to know. But let me just add a couple more points here just that are worth bearing in mind on this issue. First is, suppose I'm wrong. Suppose that the failure of a Christian theist, Christian believer in God, to provide an answer does mean it's probable that there is none. What would follow from that? Well, it would mean that the existence of God is improbable given the amount of suffering in the world. What follows from that? Well, actually not as much as you might think. Because the fact that the existence of God is improbable on one fact about the world doesn't mean the existence of God is improbable. This often isn't realized. There are many beliefs which we hold which are actually improbable on some fact that we know to be true. And yet we're perfectly rational in accepting them. For example, I'm playing poker. I'm dealt four aces. And I see the four aces in front of me. I'm dealt the hand, right? Quite rational in believing that I was dealt four aces. I can see it, right? They deal me four aces. I look at my hand, four aces. Right, I've got a rational belief that there's four aces in my hand. Yet, it's highly improbable, given the number of cards in the pack and the number of possible combinations, that I was dealt four aces. Given those two factors, improbable. But yet, I can still believe it rationally. Why? Well, because in addition to those other facts, I have this other information, I can see it. You know, I'm irrational in believing it because there are other grounds which justify it. Right? I can perceive it. And similarly, a belief can be improbable on one subset of what you know, and yet... it can be improbable on some set of things you know, and yet highly probable given everything you know. So here's another example. I know my friend is French, and let's say I also know that most French can't swim. That's probably not true, but let's just say it was the case, right? I would say play rugby, but that tends to be unreliable in World Cups. So I know my friend is a Frenchman, and most Frenchmen can't swim, right? So given my belief that he's a Frenchman, and given my belief that he can't swim, it's probable that he can't swim. But let's suppose in addition to this, I also know that he's a lifesaver. And I know that pretty much all lifesavers can swim, even French ones, right? So when you add that belief, it goes from a situation where it's improbable on the subset to it's probable overall. Okay? So what this tells us is the fact that belief in God or a religious belief is improbable on the existence of suffering doesn't actually make the belief improbable. What the skeptic would have to show is that when you take into account everything else you know, it remains improbable. You'd have to look at all the other relevant information, all the other arguments for it, all the other considerations given in favor of it, and show that on the total, the whole lot, together, it's improbable. Right? And our second point I want to make about this objection is that I think the question also needs to be raised about how well Christianity does regarding the existence of evil relative to other alternative views. So, for example, suppose you reject Christianity because you think, well, it doesn't really account for evil. You can still question, well, has the view you've now adopted instead of Christianity, can that account for evil as well? Because if it can't, you have no basis for rejecting Christianity and accepting that belief. Right? You can't reject Christianity because it doesn't account for evil and then adopt another view, belief that also can't account for evil, right? If you'd be consistent. Either you reject both of them or you realize it's not a problem, right? And some people have at least suggested that there might be reasons for thinking that suffering and evil are improbable if God doesn't exist. Right? I'll give you just a couple of considerations. First, in order for suffering to exist, sentient life forms must exist. And there are various discoveries from contemporary physics which suggest that a universe evolving life is extremely improbable for a universe to evolve sentient life. For life to evolve, there must be around 15 constants necessary. Each must have precise values, and if they were off by the slightest amount, life could not evolve. So one guy who works in this area, a guy called Robin Collins, notes that if some of these constants, these 15 constants, had differed by 1 in 10 to the power of 60, sentient life would not evolve. Okay? So there are questions around this, and I'm not necessarily endorsing this argument, but you know, this is a question that needs to be honestly faced. Second, some of the worst forms of evil involve human cruelty and wickedness. But this seems to require that the existence of moral obligations to not be wicked and not to do horrible things. And one question can be raised is whether a secular view of the world can account for the existence of these moral things as well as a religious account can. And again, there's a lot of debate about this. My point is not to endorse these lines of inquiry, though to some of them I'm sympathetic. But my point is not to endorse them. It's simply to show that it's not obvious that the standard skeptical view is any more probable, given the existence of evil, than belief in God is. Right? It's not more obvious that the skeptical view makes better sense of evil than the religious view does. It might be a problem for both views. It might be something that both views have a hard time explaining. But if that's the case, then you can't rationally adopt the skeptical stance, well, because Christianity doesn't explain evil. Unless you yourself are willing to offer the same kind of skeptical, the same kind of response to those questions that you demand the Christian make to the problem of evil. If you demand the Christian explain this to you, then the skeptic has to explain this as well. And we shouldn't let him get away with not explaining it. Right? Hold him to his own standard. So, just to sum up on this whole issue of evil and suffering, really there were three brief sketches of arguments I gave. First, I want to suggest the objection relies on an assumption which seems to me false, the idea that if I don't know of any reason why God will allow something he hadn't done. Right? Second, even if evil does make the existence of evil improbable, you would need further argument to show that this means Christianity was irrational. You would need to show that there was nothing else that was relevant, which, when added to this fact, made the existence of God probable. You'd have to look at the various people's claims to religious experience. You'd have to look at the various arguments for the existence of God. You'd have to look at various revelations that have been proposed. You'd have to show that when you take into account all these things, God does not exist, right? Can't just raise the issue of evil. Third, even if one did this, one still, I think, would need to show that the alternative to Christianity that was being proposed was able to better account for the existence of evil. And what I'm saying to you is I don't think these three things are generally done by in most skeptical contexts where people ask the question, why is there evil? Right? There's an awful lot of work that needs to be done for this objection to be given the kind of weight that it's put forward. But often what happens is it's in a very emotional and difficult situation where a person's grieving and they need our help and support. But at the same time, we also need to point out what is the rational, true situation, you know, and not justify serious decisions about truth and about your fundamental allegiances for God and against God and what have you, or towards God, on the basis of very difficult emotional situations. Part of being good, caring people is actually counseling people to not make decisions like that in those kinds of circumstances. All right? So, conclusion, I think I've sketched to you a little bit about what this idea of apologetics is, and I've sketched to you something of what's involved in it scripturally and its role in the scriptures. And I've sketched you a kind of way of thinking about doubt put forward by Timothy Keller. And I've proposed three examples of where this sort of method could be used and given you some examples of how it might be used. So I'll close there and just leave it at that. And I hope that was helpful to you. And I hope you learned from it. And I will open now for Q&A, I guess. Thank you.
We'll have Q&A. We'll maybe give Matt 2 minutes just to have a little break and give you guys a chance to go to the washroom or what have you, and then come back in 2 minutes and be prepared to grill Matt on everything he just said. Yeah. Okay. Again, the bathrooms are just back there in that through those doors right there. I'm also heavily involved in Thinking Matters Auckland. And if you've come here today and you're more interested in learning more about these types of events, I encourage you to write your email down. Also, if you're interested in going into schools, into high schools, and answering questions about the Christian faith, that's something that, you know what, I want to start actually going into real situations where I can answer real questions from real people about the real truth of Christianity, then please put down your email, come talk to me after, and I can talk to you about how to get involved in that type of activity. Also, if you want to know about other events and other things where we create situations where you're able to actually practice and develop your ability to articulate the Christian gospel here in New Zealand in the 21st century, then, again, put your email down. And, so I guess we will begin. Does anyone have a question for Matt?
Yep. There are a couple of things there. Firstly, that claim, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. I'd want to unpack what that slogan meant. Sometimes people cite slogans thinking that they're saying something profound, and when you unpack them, you find that they're not something profound. So firstly, why is Christianity an extraordinary claim? The first thing I'd ask. And generally the answer would be something along, well, it suggests that supernatural things can happen, right? Like miracles or somebody rises from the dead. There are a couple of things there. Firstly, that assumes that belief in the supernatural is extraordinary and belief in the natural world by itself is an ordinary thing. Don't know why we should think that. Most cultures throughout history have not held that view. But secondly, if that's what's meant by extraordinary, then the argument seems to be a bit weird, because they're saying extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Are they now saying that supernatural claims require supernatural evidence? Well, generally they're not. Generally they're saying, well, you must verify it by natural science. So they seem to be using this word extraordinary in a kind of funny way. So I'd want to know exactly what they're saying by that slogan, firstly. Now, often what they're saying is something along the lines of that. They're often saying something a bit like this. They're saying, if you're going to make a claim that there's something beyond the physical world, then you need to prove it. That's usually what they mean. Well, then I would just ask, well, why should I accept that assumption? And why should I accept that if I'm making a claim beyond the existence of the physical world, I have to prove it? What's the basis for that claim? And I'd hear the argument they'd give. And it seems to me that that claim is by itself, I mean, it seems to me there's certain areas where that claim's quite problematic. One area where it's problematic is in the area of morality, right? Take the claim, rape is wrong. Is that a claim about the natural world? Well, it's not clear that it is. It's not obvious that it is. It might be, it might not be, but, you know, so there are examples like that I'd put to them and say, well, you know, unless you can show me that that's a purely natural claim, I'm going to ask you to prove that. But surely we need to walk around proving claims like that before we stop raping people, right? That would be absurd. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the claim, are there any proofs for Christianity? A lot there depends on what you mean by proof. In logic and in mathematics, the word proof has a very strict sense. You know, you must have self-evident axioms and be able to prove it mathematically. Now, in that sense, no, there's no proof for God. But then again, in that sense, there's no proof for most things we believe, in that very strict sense. Now, is the claim that there are some compelling arguments for God's existence? Well, I actually think that there is the numerous books been put forward by Christian philosophers and what have you that put forward very sophisticated arguments for God's existence. And I wouldn't let a skeptic come up to me and say, there are no arguments, unless I want to know how many he's bothered to actually look at. You know, if someone just comes up to me and says, oh, look, there are no Muslims in Auckland, but I've never been to Auckland and I've never looked at anywhere, I've never checked it out and I've never examined it, then their claim that there are no Muslims in Auckland is totally baseless, right? You can only make that claim if you've done a survey of the Auckland area and done the relevant survey and checked what the religious demographic in the area is and so on, right? So if someone says there are no arguments for God's existence, they all fail, we'll say, well, have you read Richard Swinburne's book, The Existence of God? Where do you find it wanting? Have you read Timothy O'Connor's argument from Contingency, which gets into really complicated issues of modal logic? Can you explain to me what's wrong with it? Can you explain to me what's wrong with Robin Collins' fine-tuning argument? Can you explain to me what's wrong with some of the work of people like Bill Craig and others on the Kalam cosmological argument? You know, where do you find those things wanting? And 9 times out of 10, they've never even heard of them. So they're making this claim, there are no proofs, or there is no evidence, but they haven't bothered to look. So then I'd say, well, if you haven't bothered to look, what's the basis of this claim? What you've given to me is a slogan and an assertion. And there is simply done what I mentioned with Timothy Keller, is I've looked at the assumptions they're making and I've asked them to apply the skepticism they profess to hold to those assumptions. Yeah. Those are just some of the things. And then to get into what their objections are and what their thoughts are about those things and so on. But yeah. Right. Well, there's a couple of things there. Firstly, there's a couple of assumptions there. Firstly, the assumption is, all right, sorry, the question was that skeptics will claim they don't believe in something, they just don't believe something. And so therefore, they don't have to offer any kind of justification for their position. A couple of things there. Firstly, I just think it's false that they don't believe in something. A good way of showing that is to ask, well, why don't you believe in God's existence? Why not? Now, either they're going to have reasons or they're not going to have reasons. If they're not going to have reasons, it's just arbitrary. If they're going to have reasons, do they think those reasons are true? Yes, well then they believe in something. If those reasons are true, why have they put it forward as an argument? They don't believe it, right? So it's not true that they don't believe in something. But secondly, it's also that claim that, you know, if you believe in something, you have to prove it. If you're skeptical, you don't. It's just totally false. Because if you think about it, if that were true, the default position would be absolute skepticism towards everything. You know? If that were true, then my starting point should be to believe nothing at all and be like a zombie until people began to prove things. But of course, if I believed nothing at all, they couldn't prove anything because anything they came up with as a proof, I wouldn't believe in. Right? The very act of engaging in proof presupposes that people already know stuff. Because proof involves saying to people, look, here are some reasons, some considerations that you should accept. And given those considerations, here's a conclusion. So again, that claim about, you know, the person who is skeptical doesn't bear a burden of proof is not true. And we would apply this in other areas too. Does that mean that in morality, the person who thinks that nothing is wrong and every action is permissible, that that's the default position we should adopt, and the burden of proof is on everybody else who says that you shouldn't rape and kill and steal? Right? So I should approach morality just assuming that everything's okay and I can do whatever I like until people convince me otherwise? Is that how we think morality functions? Are they going to apply that to the basic tenets of science? Well, look, I just don't believe in them, so you have to prove that to me. Are they going to apply that to every other belief that they hold? I doubt it. Okay. So again, same basic idea.
On the other extreme,
yep.
You get people arguing,
okay, so there the argument is that as science advances, you have a shrinking God situation, right? As science explains more, God explains less. Well, firstly, notice that's a historical claim, right? It's a claim about the history of Western thought or the history of thought in the world in general. And the claim is that once religion explained all this stuff here, and then science has advanced by gradually explaining it and that's shrunken. Well, firstly, I want to know, what's the basis for that historical claim? Because I just don't think that's true. And I'll give you an example of why I don't think it's true. In the 12th century, before the scientific revolution that we know of, which came in the 17th century, there was a book by a man called Thomas Aquinas called the Summa Theologicae. Thomas Aquinas was a very famous Catholic theologian who wrote in the Middle Ages. And there's a very, very famous section of that called the Five Ways, which are five arguments Aquinas gave for the existence of God. A lot of people don't realize about that section of the Summa Theologicae is that he has a list of objections that were being raised against the existence of God in this time. And one of them was, we don't need God to explain anything because all our modern Aristotelian science has already explained it all. Okay? This was in the 12th century, 13th century, right? AD. And Aquinas says, well, actually, he hasn't explained everything. He hasn't explained the origin of the universe. Hasn't explained why the universe continues to exist. Hasn't explained values. And hasn't explained purpose. That's not true. Now, let's come forward to today, 21st century. Same arguments, same issues, right? Same arguments being put forward for the existence of God. Where's this progress of science? Where is it? What often happens when people say that is they have this kind of crude idea that, you know, people in the Middle Ages believed in God because they couldn't explain lightning or something. You know, or people in the ancient Greek world couldn't explain the existence of noise or something, or thunder, and so they postulated the existence of Zeus. I mean, that's just nonsense to the history of religious thought, you know. They don't have the right to make a historical claim like that, a sweeping historical claim without any basis whatsoever, any evidence. Second thing about that argument assumes that unless something can be explained by science, you know, unless it can kind of function as a scientific explanation, we shouldn't believe it. And that again is false as well. There are many things that we believe which don't function as a scientific explanation. Again, I'd use the example of morality, you know. What does the claim rape is wrong explain empirically? In fact, one of the arguments for nihilism, for the non-existence of moral values, is precisely that it doesn't provide a scientific explanation for anything, right? And in fact, to explain something, you already have to believe something because you're trying to explain something that you see to be true. And you say, well, why is that? So in order to engage in explanation, you already have to believe stuff. So you can't claim that everything that sort of functions as a scientific explanation. So I would say that the assumption they're making about knowledge is there is questionable as well. Yeah.
Sorry, I just
Yeah. 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 Well, I agree with you in the sense that often people who make this argument have this kind of understanding of what it means for God to be all-powerful, which is not necessarily what Christians mean by that. You know, for example, I don't think that God could command people to torture everyone as much as possible for fun all the time, right? Because Christians don't just believe that God is all-powerful, they also believe that he's essentially good. And it would be nonsensical to say that a being who is essentially God commanded those kinds of things. So there are questions about when a Christian says God is all-powerful, what they mean. And you're quite right. There may be many things in the world which it's simply not possible logically to allow this if you also don't allow this, right? So I think that's true. I think it's true. And free will is one example where people sometimes use of that, you know, that God couldn't give people freedom and also determine what they do. You know, the problem with the free will issue is that it can be, it doesn't explain everything. You know, there's certain forms of evil like earthquakes or animal suffering or plagues or whatever, which may not be necessarily easily explained in terms of free will. But I think the basic point that you're making is correct. And also, too, then, and it may well be the case, and I'm inclined to think this is probably true, that there are certain things in this world, certain goods in this world, this side of eternity, that actually couldn't occur if evil didn't occur. You know, I mean, there's one philosopher, Robert Adams, who has made the case that none of us could exist if World War II didn't happen. You know, because if World War II hadn't happened, the people who met a generation ago would have been very different. They would have met at different ages, you know, different demographic of the world in terms of who had been killed and who hadn't been killed, who would have married, and there wouldn't have been a baby boom in the 1940s, all this sort of stuff. So a totally different generation of people would have come along. World history would have been totally different. You know, you wouldn't have Cold War. So in other words, there are lots of things in our world which couldn't have happened if evil didn't happen. And the world has the structure it has. So you'd have to change a lot of things, right? And once you start realizing this, you realize that it's not just as simple as saying, well, you know, God could have prevented that. Well, yeah, maybe he could have prevented that, but then what else would have had to have been different in the world, right? And what were the costs and benefits of that and so on. But, yeah. Yeah.
How does that connect,
yeah,
more importantly, with liberty? How often do we get to be,
yeah,
to the point where we no longer we write and say, close off all avenues of that point?
Well, I mean, I agree with you in this. I mean, the question was about, with apologetics, there can be this danger of, you know, always being right and shutting off further communication. And I mean, I agree with you. We should be in dialogue with people. And we should be doing that holistically. You know, we shouldn't be arrogant jerks that go around and say, I'm right, you're wrong, you just have to shut up and listen to me, or anything like that, right? We need to be sensitive. We need to be winsome. We need to be careful. I'm not suggesting that you engage in this kind of enterprise without those things. But I also think it can be problematic to engage in those other things without doing apologetics. So if you just walk in and just, I'm going to proclaim the gospel, and every time someone asks a question, Jesus loves you and he saves you, you'll find that's a very ineffective evangelism. So the second question you asked was about apologetic method. And I think there are many different areas where apologetics goes here, and there's many different people who specialize in different areas. So one basic area of apologetics is responding to objections to the Christian faith. When people raise issues, that we have credible responses to them. And I think that's important, and that's a really important in evangelism, I think. You know, you give a proclamation, and somebody comes back with something. What do you say? I was in a church in the US a few months ago where they had a youth service, and it was a situation where it was what you call the Slavic Baptist Church. And so there were people who came to America who spoke Russian, but their young were Americans. The young people were Americans. And so they had this service, and this guy got up and he gave his testimony. Have you seen this in church circles where they give a testimony? And this guy gave this really interesting testimony. He had been a US Ranger, and he'd, you know, come to faith in Afghanistan, you know, fighting against the Taliban, this kind of, really, you know, kind of story that would get young people really interested, right? And so he gave this proclamation. And then afterwards, we went out the back to the youth group and sat there for 2 hours fielding their questions. So that's an important part of proclamation. Sometimes apologetics can be part of the proclamation process where, you know, people start asking questions and you start giving them positive reasons for Christianity. That's different to responding to objections, right? It's what you call positive apologetics. And sometimes that can be very fruitful. I had an experience several months ago. My wife's a lawyer, and she's been admitted to the bar in the last 12 months. And so over Christmas, she got all these kind of law society function, you know, invites. And we went to a major function in Auckland where you're with all these top-level lawyers, you know, all these people who are up-and-coming legal professionals in New Zealand are on the top of this building and all this sort of stuff. And these people come up to me and they say, oh, you know, there's these high-powered lawyers making lots of money, you know, very, very, you know, and you know, lawyers can have a bit of an ego, right? But, you know, and they said to me, what do you do? And I said, I'm a theologian. And immediately I say this, there's this kind of silence falls over the room. Okay, now I know what's coming, you know. And it was really interesting. This guy then started saying, I've been reading Richard Dawkins. What do you think of it? And I said, I think it's crap. You know, without thinking, this is what I said. And he looks at me and he goes, oh, you have to say that, you're a theologian. I said, well, actually, no, I don't have to say that because I read works of skeptics all the time. And some of them are really some of them are competent pieces of scholarship, which I disagree with, and I have to develop a response to, but that book I don't think is. It's different. Well, why do you think that? So I gave him some reasons. And then he started asking me about the historical evidence for Christianity and the resurrection and things like this. And then he started to think, oh, this is interesting. He started inviting his friends to come over and talk about this, you know. And then afterwards, after the conversation sort of dies down a bit and people move on, this guy comes up to me and he says, I'm a lawyer and I've started in this firm. And he came from some small town in the South Island. And he says, and I've realized that I've suddenly made it. You know, I'm making all this money, this big dream. And you know what? I'm worried I'm my soul. I really understand what the purpose of all this is. Anyway, that proclamation came because I had that conversation. Now, they had this situation where they were these, you know, educated lawyers. They know better. They read Richard Dawkins. I'm a theologian, so therefore I'm something in a zoo that you look at, this sort of thing, right? to that position, because after that conversation, I piqued their interest and I earned their respect. Right? And so then they felt free to open up and ask these questions. And you'll find that when you do apologetics, this happens all the time. There's this back and forth that goes on. It's a complete fiction to imagine apologetics as these people who just give these really cold, rationalistic arguments, I'm right, beat people up intellectually and walk away. It actually doesn't work that way. And in actual fact, sometimes when you have this kind of intellectual tussle, people are sort of testing you out and they're trying you out and they're seeing if you're worthy of respect. They're seeing if what you say has got the goods, right? And so when you go through this process, I had one process where I was in a pub and I had this guy who was a leading atheist writer. And I sat down, the first thing he says to me, belief in God is stupid. And I thought, he's picking a fight, right? You know, he does this. And he was at me with all this stuff, the Inquisition, for a couple of hours. He just went at it. And everything he said, I responded to him. And I got to the point where I just got frustrated because he was going around in circles and being really. And I just said to him, look, have you got anything other than an insult and a caricature? Let me know. And I felt, oh man, I lost my temper, I was really bad, you know. He invited me back, invited me to his house a few days later. I spoke to a whole lot of his skeptical friends, asked me all these questions. He invited me to all kinds of functions. I was the only Christian at any of those functions because what happened was I earned his respect. So sometimes it's not what it appears to be. Yeah, any other questions? Right. I'll say a couple of things about that. Firstly is that you're never going to be in a situation, I think, where you have all the answers. Right? You're always going to be in a situation where you're always learning. And the question was about what do you do when you have a debate and you can't come up with an answer. But I'll say a couple of things. As you do this and you get better in it, you study more, some of those things bother you less. Because if you have 20 questions and you find that 15 of them have solid answers, then the fact that you five don't have you can't work out five seems less of a problem to you than when you can't work out all 20, right? And so you actually do gain confidence in the processes. As you go over time, I can look back and think there was a time when I struggled with this and I resolved it. And then there's a time when I struggled with this and I resolved it. And there's this growth period where you actually gain confidence. And as you begin to study, as I began to study skeptics, I realized, look, they have problems with their views too, you know. These things happen. So that's one thing. The other thing is I like to try and work by the motto is if somebody raises something and on the spot I really didn't have a really good response to it, that I think to myself, okay, what can I learn from that? What can I now find out? So that if that happens again, I've got something sensible to say. And so you can use those kinds of experiences as a growth process, as a process whereby you advance your understanding of God and the kingdom of God. And so you do this, okay, I didn't understand that. That's something I really need to think about more. That's something I need to look into more in case someone asks me again, right? And so it becomes a process of growth. The other thing is that you will find, too, is that 9 times out of 10, the same things are raised over and over again. So, you know, most meetings that I've spoken in, the same issues come up every time. I go to a youth group, it's the same things I'll say on a university campus, you know, over and over and over again. And so you actually get used to what people are going to say. You get used to answering what they're going to say. You get used to talking to them. You kind of know where people are coming from. And that, I think, is actually important as a Christian to know where people are coming from, to know what their struggles are and what their issues are and how you can say something relevant to them. Yeah. Yeah. I'll say a couple. I mean, the question was there about the role of testimony and the whole apologetics enterprise, and also the claim that in certain situations, the questioner had not known what to say and they felt the Holy Spirit quickened them and gave them an answer. We'll say a couple of things about that. Firstly, when the Bible uses the word testimony, it's not clear to me that it's referring to my personal story. You know, the apostles were testifying to what they had seen, which was the risen Christ. That said, I'm not opposed to you sharing your life experiences. You know, if you've learned something in life, if you've had been down and out and you've had an encounter with God and that's transformed you, there's nothing wrong with sharing that. But what I would be concerned about was if that was the be-all and end-all of Christian evangelism. Because I can turn on an infomercial on a Saturday morning and there were plenty of people telling me that there's this wonderful thing that's changed their life. You know, and there'll be Muslims who have turned their lives around because they did drugs or whatever and they converted to Islam and there was a strict moral code and what have you, right? So we need to be able to incorporate our testimony and our personal experience with our also knowledge and understanding of truth and the ability to respond to people and what have you. They need to work together. So when you say, I have this encounter with God and he transformed my life and it done all these things for me and I also know it's true. And both things go together. The other thing, I just before you do follow up, the other thing is, as you mentioned, is the Holy Spirit giving you. You say, I mean, I believe God can do that. I mean, I think God can assist and help you. When I speak in public, I always pray beforehand and I ask that God will assist me and what have you. So, you know, and God can do that. But again, I would be very careful about taking it, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but taking an attitude whereby, well, I don't really need to prepare for this because God will just give me the words. Because I think sometimes people use God as an excuse for laziness. And it's a bit like Jesus when he was asked to jump off the temple. You know, jump off the temple and God will save you. Well, why would I do something stupid like that? Why would I jump off the temple? Well, no. I think it's a both and thing. We need to pray and rely on God, but I also think we have to do our part of just being responsible people. And I would never counsel a Christian to sort of say, well, look, walk into a den of skeptics and don't do any preparation at all. Just pray and God will give you the words. I think that's tempting God in a way that is mistaken. I don't think that God's providence works. You know, God's providence works in such a way that it works through the normal as well as the supernatural. You know, in fact, God's providence normally works through the normal. Right. Yeah, you wanted to say something to follow up? Sure, I mean, what you're talking about there, you're talking about a situation where she talked to a woman who had asked her about what about suffering, and she shared her experience in her own life of dealing with suffering and how to help this woman. What you're dealing with there is actually an important general thing, and that's about discerning what the person's actually saying. So sometimes when a person raises the question, why is there evil, what they're really saying is, I'm really hurting, can you help me? Sometimes. Sometimes what they're saying is, why is there evil? And we need to be discerning. It can be really problematic to, when someone asks a serious question, to sort of say, well, look, there's just this emotional issue, I'll ignore the question. But it can also be really cold when someone's got these deep emotional needs to give them this kind of philosophical lecture and not deal with those emotional needs. So we need to be discerning with our audience, and we're quite right. Sometimes when people raise those issues, what's really going on is something else, and you can provide them with some kind of help and assistance. And so, again, it's not a case of either or. I think it's a case of both and having the wisdom and the maturity and learning which is the appropriate response at the time. And I hope the church would do both. I hope the church would answer people's intellectual questions about that, but also help those who are suffering. All right? Well, asked about the best channel for engaging in this, and particularly about online things. Well, online discussions can be very unproductive, for the obvious reason is that there's a lot of social inhibitions that people have when they talk to one another. You know, if I stand up here and talk, it's actually an intimidating experience, right? I stand here, there's a whole group of people looking at me, they're going to ask me any old question, I've got to answer it, all eyes are on me. There's a lot of actually, you know, social stuff there that's intimidating, that puts you on your edge a bit and what have you. And so you're much more careful in a face-to-face context. When you say something really nasty to someone, they might punch you in the face, right? But online, that's not there. You can say whatever you like. You're totally anonymous, right? And so online, people often just say all kinds of garbage. You know, and one place where I never interact is YouTube. It's just a waste of time, you know. Comments in YouTube are just like three, you know, there's no point. But what I will say is you've got to realize is that when you're dealing online, it's not just you and the person you're dialoguing with who are actually reading the exchange. Something I learned very early on at university when I used to have discussions in the student newspaper with people is your audience sometimes with the kind of really hostile, nasty person online is actually not that hostile, nasty person. It's various other people who might be sympathetic to that person's viewpoint but aren't a nasty, hostile jerk, right? And they're looking at you, how you respond to it. Okay, so that's one thing there. The other thing is I find that as you do this, it often doesn't become a kind of formal planned, I'm going to go out and do this. It's not like I'm going to street evangelism, I walk out. What I find is it just comes up. You know, because in our society today, people actually are asking these questions, but it's this kind of social faux pas that you never talk about religion in public, right? But people actually are genuinely asking these questions, and there's things in the media, and I've had all kinds of, I was at a funeral one time, my own mother's funeral. And my mother had just died, and some guys who were there, you know, were drinking a bit of beer because they're a bit depressed, and you know, and they came up to me when they had loosened up a little because they had too much alcohol, and they came up to me and they said to me, "So Matt, what do you think of Constantine writing the Bible in the 3rd century?" Seriously, at a wake, right? I went out to a birthday party with a guy one time. It was his birthday party. He invited me and my wife out because my wife had been involved in some litigation or something that he'd been on the fringe of. He invited us out to his birthday party, and I'm there, and he's this really rough-as-guts guy, you know. He's gully back spirit, he's tattooed, he's really, you know, really, every second word starts with F, you know. And he says to me, he says, "Matt, why does God allow pedophiles? I want to talk to you because you're a theologian, and I know that you know this stuff." Seriously, right? And this is what happens. People will, in all kinds of situations, just suddenly, this will suddenly just come up. And if you, particularly if you start to give sensible answers, people will seek you out for those answers. And then this may surprise you, but they will, because I think, you know, I've heard all this stuff, and I don't trust any of the other people, but, you know, John over there, he's got his head switched on. I want to talk to him about it. And this is what happens. And some of my most productive experiences happen like that. But that's on the back of the other things I do, where people know, well, look, Matt's written this. I respect what he writes. I'm going to ask him a question. Yeah. Okay. But I think that closes the questions, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much. There's no time when you have to leave, so I'm sure Matt would mind talking a little bit afterwards. There's coffee and tea if you want some to continue the discussion here. And, so just feel free to use this time to talk to people who are interested in these things. Let's give Matt an applause.